Despite our best efforts to keep quiet, we couldn't avoid a certain amount of metallic clatter from all the weapons we were carrying. The non-com came back, and we set out again, walking forward another short distance to the foxholes at the edge of the wood, where our scouts were waiting, as quiet as snakes. We threw ourselves down into their short drench. "As flat as you can," whispered the Sudeten, who in principle walked just ahead of me. "Pass it on." One by one, we left the last German positions, and crawled out onto the warm earth of no man's land. I kept my eyes glued to the hobnailed soles of the Sudeten's boots, trying nervously to keep in sight all that could be seen of my closest companion. From time to time the air ahead of me would darken with the looming shape of a comrade who had to climb over some obstacle. At other moments, the soles of the boots ahead of me would suddenly stop inches from the end of my nose. Then I would be gripped by a horrible anxiety. Maybe the Sudeten had lost sight of the fellow in front of him. A moment later he would begin to move again, and the instinctive confidence I felt as part of the group would unknot my throat. During such moments, even naturally reflective characters suddenly feel their heads emptying, and nothing seems to matter except the dry, cracking stick pressing into one's stomach, which one must somehow crush and pass over without making any noise. A new, hitherto unsuspected acuteness sharpens every sense, and the tension seems pressing enough to subdue one's wildly racing heart. We inched slowly forward across that damnable Russian soil, which all of us had already trampled more than enough. We had to crawl around a short stretch of light sand against which we would show up too easily, crushing under our bodies a mat of thorny creepers which we took at first for Russian barbed wire. Then we came to a mossy hollow where we stopped for a moment. Our sergeant, who had a very good sense of direction, was going over our route in his head, trying to fix our position. The hollow reeked with a pestilential smell. When we began to move again, I was startled to see two motionless figures lying on the sand some 2 yards to our right. I pointed at them, nudging the veteran, who looked and grabbed his nose. With a shock of horror, I understood that we had just passed two corpses, which were quietly rotting as they waited for burial in a common grave. We seemed to have crawled as far as China. About half an hour after we had started, we came to the first Russian wire. We waited with beating hearts while our first men opened a precarious passage. Every time we heard the cutter's snap, we expected to see a spray of dirt shooting up from an exploding mine. Our faces, blackened with soot from the canteen kettles, were pouring with sweat, and the tension was so great we certainly must have aged several years during the few minutes we needed to crawl under the Soviet wire, at a speed of about 15 yards an hour. When we had all made it through, we stopped for several moments and huddled together. Every one of us was trembling. We could hear faint sounds from the Russian forward positions. We rolled our eyes at each other and understood without words that we all felt the same way. We crept forward another 20 yards to a stand of low scrub or tall grass. We could hear the sound of voices and knew beyond any doubt that we had reached the first Russian line. Suddenly, we were staring incredulously at an almost invisible figure, a Soviet reconnaissance man, who was bending over a hole which undoubtedly contained some of his comrades. We almost stopped breathing, and slowly lifted our guns, looking at our leader, who seemed to have frozen, and then at each other, with a look beyond expression, as the Russian walked slowly toward us. Then he turned back. Our sergeant pulled a knife from his belt. Its blade flashed white for a moment, before he thrust it slowly into the ground in front of Grumpers, pointing to the Russian with one finger. The grenadier opened his eyes enormously wide, and looked with horror from the Russian to the knife to the sergeant. The latter gestured him on, as Grumpers' quivering hand clenched round the knife handle. With a final mute look of supplication, the grenadier began to creep forward. We followed the progress of his dark shape with an anxiety which made us clench our teeth to keep from crying out. Then he was lost in the darkness. The Russian was still talking to his friends, as if the war were thousands of miles away. He took a few more steps. We could hear more voices a little farther off. For a few long moments, Each of us forgot his own existence. The Russian walked toward the spot where Grumpus must have hidden, and turned back. As he turned, a second silhouette rose up behind him. Grumpus covered the 4 or 5 yards that separated him from his quarry in one jump. The Russian whirled around. We heard a rough cry and the sound of a struggle. From a hole a short way off, we heard Russian voices. Then we were able to distinguish the silhouette of our grenadier rolling on the ground, and hear the sound of his voice. Hilf, Kameraden. The Russian jumped to one side, and the sound of his machine gun tore into the quiet of the night, as its white flashes striped the darkness. To my left another machine gun opened fire, and its bullets followed the howling Russian as far as the earth embankment in front of the foxhole, into which he finally plunged. From the hole, we could hear voices shouting, Germansky! Germansky! With a leap which looked beyond his capacities, the veteran propelled himself forward, hurling a grenade from his right fist. The object vanished into the darkness for 2 or 3 seconds. Then the hole was lit by a brilliant white light, and we heard the outcry of several voices, before a moment of silence. We withdrew as fast as we could, keeping parallel to the barbed wire. Behind us, we could hear a rising tumult. Risking mines and bullets, we ran for a small hillock, and, gasping for breath, hastily attempted to organize a defensible position in a thicket. Idiots! The sergeant exploded, meaning Krause and the veteran. I didn't give an order to fire. We'll never get out of this now. He was as scared as anybody else. But Grumpus asked for help, Sergeant, Krause answered. He was in bad trouble. An instant later a dozen flares lit our surroundings as brightly as day, and a Russian fusillade shook the air all around us. The Russians were also heaving grenades at random, the way we would have done. We're finished, whimpered young Lindbergh. Quick, a shovel, shouted the Sudeten. We've got to dig in, or they'll slaughter us. Nobody move. The veteran commanded authoritatively. In our terror, we obeyed him. His voice sounded more confident than the sergeant's. We tried to freeze absolutely, even down to the fluttering of our eyelids. A flare burst into brilliant white light directly overhead, and anyone whose face wasn't buried in the ground could see every detail of our circumstances. Just beyond us lay the bodies of Grumpus and the Russian, and 5 or 6 foxholes preceding a V-shaped infantry position. Other flares lit the edge of the wood from which our adventures had begun. Luckily, the Russians nearest us hadn't noticed the rise of ground which was giving us cover. However, their soldiers in the more distant positions which we had seen in the light of the flares could see us. They began to throw grenades too, and they were using the superb Russian grenade throwers. God, said the veteran. If they've got those damned things, we've had it. We ought to dig. Snivelled Lindbergh. Shut up. Dig with your belly if you like. But don't move anything else. If we play dead, maybe they'll think we are. Something fell with a dull thud on the other side of the hillock. Its crest disintegrated, and we were spattered by a rain of earth. There were no new flares coming over, and the ones still falling were fading. As usual, the Russians were shouting curses at us. Another grenade landed somewhere to our left, and we could hear the whistling fall of its fragments through the noise of the explosion. Someone lying beside the veteran groaned. Shut up. Hold it back. Muttered the veteran between clenched teeth. If they hear anything, that's it. He was talking to his number 2 man. The boy was clawing at his face, which was twisted with pain. His hands were trembling. Don't make a sound. Said the veteran, putting his hand on the boy's forearm. Be strong. Grenades were still falling all around us. The boy clenched his fists, and his eyes flooded with tears. He sniffed. Quiet, insisted the veteran. The flares died out, and everything around us became pitch black. The Russians must have spotted another group of our men somewhat to the north of us. It was their turn to get the lights and the noise. Then we heard other sounds directly ahead of us. By deliberately dilating our pupils as wide as we could, we were able to distinguish several men creeping forward parallel to our position. A cold sweat trickled down our backs. The veteran was holding a large grenade about 4 inches from my nose. Once again, we froze. The hunched figures came toward us as far as the barbed wire, and then turned back. We all breathed again. The wounded boy buried his face in the ground, to try to stifle his groans. "They're just as scared as we are," said the veteran. "Somebody orders them up here to see what's going on, so they take a few steps and then run back as fast as they can and say they don't see anything." "It's almost dawn," whispered Arnoncom. "I think we could stay here. It seems a pretty good spot." "I don't, Sergeant. I think we should get out." "Maybe you're right. You," he said, pointing to Hal's. "There's a hole about 20 yards from here, level with the barbed wire. You get over there." Hal's and Lindbergh slid off like snakes. "Where are you hurt?" the veteran asked the wounded boy, touching him on the shoulder. The young man lifted his face, which was smeared with dirt and tears. "I can't move," he said. "Something hurts here." He touched his hip. "A splinter. Don't move. We'll send someone to help you." "Yes," said the boy, thrusting his face back into the dirt. "Our assault troops should be here in 10 or 15 minutes, if everything goes well," said the non-com, looking at his watch. The horizon was beginning to turn pink. Soon the sun would be up. We waited feverishly. "Isn't there going to be a bombardment first?" asked Kraus. "Lucky there's not," said the veteran. "We'd get it just as badly as the Popoffs." "There won't be," said the sergeant. "The first waves are supposed to take the enemy by surprise. We're here to neutralize enemy defense, but our fellows might mistake us for Russians, and do us in." "Exactly," said the veteran, laughing. Russian voices came to us in bursts as clearly as if we were in the trench with them. "At least they don't seem worried," the Czech remarked. "What's the use of worrying? We'll all be dead in an hour anyway," said the veteran, as if he were thinking aloud. The light was increasing rapidly. Everything was still grey, but we could distinguish a portion of the Russian V position in line with the veteran's spandau, and lower down to the left, a motionless grey mass. "Hals, Lindbergh, and the FM, you young fellow," said the veteran, looking at me. "You'll replace my number 2 man. Get over here on my left." "Right," I said, worming my way toward him. A minute later, my nose was pressed against the metal of the FM's magazine. We could see most of the details of the Russian position 100 yards ahead of us. From our hillock overlooking the enemy, we glimpsed momentary snatches of pale faces, like faces in a dream. It now seems to me astonishing that the Russians hadn't occupied our little hill. However, there were similar rises in the ground all around us, and they couldn't have occupied all of it. We were staring straight ahead when our leader's hand pointed to our rear left. "Look," he said, in almost full voice. We carefully turned our heads the way he was pointing, and saw the bodies of many men slithering along the ground, breaking through the network of Russian protection. As far as we could see, the ground was covered with creeping figures. "They're ours," said the veteran, and a faint smile crossed his face. "Get ready to fire, if anyone moves in Ivan's hole," our leader added. Suddenly, I began to shake uncontrollably, not precisely because of fear, but because at that moment, when our mission was about to be accomplished, all the nervousness and anxiety which I had been able to master until then burst out in violent spasms. I tried shifting my weight, but nothing did any good. I managed to open the magazine and nervously slip the first belt into the breech of the gun, which the veteran held open for me, and left partly open, to prevent the sound of its clicking shut. Far to our left, the dance had already begun. A dance which would surely have inspired Saintsons, and which lasted for days. A moment later, among the German troops we were watching, someone must have pulled a wire attached to a string of mines. Our immediate surroundings, the Russian position, the bodies of Grumpers and his adversary, our little hill, and all our hearts were shaken by a series of thunderous explosions. For a moment we thought that the whole mass of creeping soldiers we had seen just the minute before had been blown to pieces. Everywhere among the Hitlerjugend, for it was they who had been crawling toward us young men, were jumping up and trying to rush through the tangles of barbed wire. Howls had just opened fire. The veteran slammed our gun shut and fitted it into the hollow of his shoulder. "Fire!" shouted the noncom. "Wipe them out." The Russians ran to take their places. The string of 7.7 cartridges slid through my hands with brutal rapidity, while the noise of the gun burst against my eardrums. I could see what was happening only with the greatest difficulty. The spandrel was shuddering and jumping on its legs, and shaking the veteran, who kept trying to steady himself. Its percussive bark put a final touch on the vast din which had broken out. Through the vibrations and smoke, we were able to observe the horrible impact of our projectiles on the lost mass of Red soldiers in the trench in front of us. Day broke over the frenzied scene, and the sky slowly lightened. From far behind us, German artillery was roaring through every tube, pounding the enemy's secondary positions. The Russians, taken by surprise, were attempting a desperate defense, but from every side the Jungjloen were surging out of the darkness, breaking like waves over their entrenchments and pulverizing both men and materiel. An overwhelming din engulfed the plain, which rang with the sound of thousands of explosions. Ahead of us, and far to the right, we were bombarding a town of considerable size. Slow spirals of smoke some 50 yards across rolled along the ground from enormous fires. I was feeding a second magazine into our infernal machine, and the veteran continued to pour his projectiles onto the dead and living who were jammed into the advanced Soviet position. Then, through all the noise, we heard the unmistakable rumble of tanks. "Our panzers!" shouted the Czech with a demoniac laugh. Howells left his position and rushed toward us with a leap which made us think he'd been hit. He and Lindbergh had run just in time. A second later, a huge tank rolled over the ground they had occupied, crushing the barbed wire beneath its treads. The churned-up earth continued to shake with the explosion of mines, which here and there immobilized a heavy armored vehicle, or tossed a Lancer some 15 yards. The tank, followed by two others, passed very close to us, thrusting toward the enemy position we had already been peppering for several minutes. In no time, it had crossed the trench, which was overflowing with the bodies of Russian soldiers. Then a second and a third tank plunged through the bloody paste, and rolled on, their treads stuck with horrible human remnants. Our noncom gave an involuntary cry of horror at the sight. Soon the young soldiers fresh from the sportive pleasures of the barracks would arrive at this foul reality. We heard a cry of horror, followed by one of victory, as the first assault wave continued its advance. More tanks were pouring out of the woods behind us, crushing the saplings and brush, and driving, almost rearing up on their treads, toward companies of infantry who had to hurry out of the way. If there were any wounded lying on the ground, that was their bad luck. The first phase of the attack was supposed to occur like a flash of lightning, with nothing permitted to hinder the progress of the tanks. An infantry group had just joined us, and their leader was talking with ours when a tank bore down exactly on our position. Everyone jumped aside. A young soldier ran toward the tank, trying to wave it off with large gestures. But the monster continued unswervingly, like a blind animal, churning up the ground a bare 2 yards from our hillock. In my haste, my foot caught on the spandrel, and I fell full length down the other side of the rise. The huge machine flattened the edge of our protection, and the steel sections of its treads rolled past, horribly close to my haggard eyes. What happened next? I retain nothing from those terrible minutes except indistinct memories which flash into my mind with sudden brutality, like apparitions, among bursts and scenes and visions that are scarcely imaginable. It is difficult even to try to remember moments during which nothing is considered, foreseen, or understood, when there is nothing under a steel helmet but an astonishingly empty head and a pair of eyes which translate nothing more than would the eyes of an animal facing mortal danger. There is nothing but the rhythm of explosions, more or less distant, more or less violent, and the cries of madmen, to be classified later, according to the outcome of the battle, as the cries of heroes or of murderers. And there are the cries of the wounded, of the agonizingly dying, shrieking as they stare at a part of their body reduced to pulp, the cries of men touched by the shock of battle before everybody else, who run in any and every direction, howling like banshees. There are the tragic, unbelievable visions, which carry from one moment of nausea to another, guts splattered across the rubble and sprayed from one dying man onto another, tightly riveted machines ripped like the belly of a cow which has just been sliced open, flaming and groaning, trees broken into tiny fragments, gaping windows pouring out torrents of billowing dust, dispersing into oblivion all that remains of a comfortable parlor. And then there are the cries of officers and non-coms, trying to shout across the cataclysm to regroup their sections and companies. That is how we took part in the German advance, being called through the noise and dust, following the clouds churned up by our tanks to the northern outskirts of Belgrade. All resistance was overwhelmed, and once again everything was either German or dead, and a sea of Russian soldiers had drawn back into the limitless confines of their country. There were thousands of prisoners, including the pro-Germans, who immediately placed in the hands of our indifferent soldiers lists of those we should shoot. There was the park of Russian vehicles hiding 2,000 or 3,000 enemy soldiers determined to slow our advance, and the Spandau, into which the veteran and I continued to feed cartridges, and houses Spandau, and the one attached to Group 10, decimated and reformed, firing and laughing as they fired, in vengeance for their fallen comrades. We sent a rain of anti-tank shells onto the park, and listened to the howls of the Russians, who no longer dared to move or surrender or attack, before flames devoured the area, and forced us to retire from their unbearable heat. Toward noon, the Soviets began to retaliate, and rained a devastating fire on the rising waves of Junjunloin. But nothing stopped the young lions, even for a moment, and the burnt-out ruin of Belgrade fell into the hands of their survivors on the second evening. In a heady state, near delirium, we went on, with almost no rest, to enlarge the wedge our troops had driven into the mass of the Soviet Central Front, a front of 150,000 men, according to our so-called information services. In fact, closer to 400,000 or 500,000 Russians were jostled back by 600 Germans. By the evening of the third day of continuous battle, during which we had only been able to snatch an occasional half hour of sleep, we were seized by the furious strength of madmen. Our group had lost both the Czech and the sergeant, and as they lay either dead or wounded among the ruins, two grenadiers who had lost their units joined us. We were now split into three groups, including the 11th, in which Olnsheim was still alive, and the 17th, which had rejoined us jointly commanded by a lieutenant. We had been ordered to reduce the pockets of resistance in the ashes of a suburb called Dipdryoka, if I remember correctly, enclaves which continued to defend themselves, although they had been left behind by the retreating Soviet forces. Our faces streaked with dust and filth and sweat stared across the ruined, apocalyptic landscape through which we were advancing, more interested in quiet corners for a few moments of sleep than in Russian strays. Explosions from the forefront of our advance were continuously shaking the air around us, and compressing our weakened lungs. No one spoke, except for an occasional halt, or Achtung, which threw us down onto the burning ground. We were so exhausted that we stood up only when our fire had subdued the isolated and hopeless resistance from some entrenched hole. Sometimes one or two prisoners might emerge from their hideout with their hands in the air, and each time the same tragedy repeated itself. Kraus killed four of them on the lieutenant's orders, the Sudeten, two, Group 17, nine. Young Lindbergh, who had been in a state of panic ever since the beginning of the offensive, and who had been either weeping in terror or laughing in hope, took Kraus's machine gun and shoved two Bolsheviks into a shell hole. The two wretched victims were both a good deal older than the boy, and kept imploring his mercy. We could hear their desperate shouts for a long time. But Lindborg, in a paroxysm of uncontrollable rage, kept firing until they were quiet. Then there was the bread house, so called because after the massacre we found a few wretched biscuits there, which we devoured, hoping to extract some return for the horrors which the war forced upon us. We were mad with harassment and exhaustion, running on our nerves, which were stretched to the utmost, and which alone made it possible to respond to the endless succession of crises and alerts. We were forbidden to take prisoners until our return trip. We knew that the Russians didn't take any, and although we longed for sleep, we knew that we had to stay awake as long as there were any Bolsheviks in our sector. It was either them or us, which is why my friend Hals and I threw grenades into the bread house, at some Russians who were trying to wave a white flag. When we reached the end of our sweep, we collapsed at the bottom of a large crater, and stared at each other for a long time in dazed silence. None of us could speak. Our uniforms were unbuttoned, torn, and so permeated with dust they were the color of the ground. The air still roared and shook and smelled of burning. Four more of our men had been killed, and we were dragging along five or six wounded, one of them Olensheim. There were about 20 of us huddled in that huge hole, trying to put our thoughts into some kind of order. But our stupefied eyes continued to wander vacantly over the burned landscape, and our heads remained empty. The radio announced that our Belgorod offensive had been crowned with success, and marked the beginning of our further progress eastward. By the fourth or fifth evening, we had gone through Belgorod without even knowing it. Our assault troops were catching their breath, and numberless ranks of infantry were sleeping on the great battered plain. We were soon loaded onto a truck and driven to a key position. I didn't understand why the ruined hamlet where we were put down was considered strategic, but grasped that this was one of the places from which the next phase of our offensive would be launched. The gently rolling landscape of fat-bellied orchards and willow-bordered streams and irrigation canals reminded me somehow of Normandy. It was occupied either by lines of defense or by rallying points for our assault troops. We began to organize our position among the poor, half-ruined houses of the hamlet. Our first job was to get rid of some 30 Bolshevik corpses scattered through the rubble. We dumped them into a small garden, which must once have been cultivated. The day was hot and heavy. A greasy sun threw sharp shadows, and made us squint in the harsh light, which emphasized every hollow in our exhausted faces. The same light poured down onto the faces of the dead Russians, whose fixed eyes were opened inordinately wide. Looking at them, and thinking about us all, made my stomach turn over. "Isn't it funny," the Sudeten remarked calmly, "how quickly a fellow's beard grows when he's dead? Look at this one." He turned over a body with his foot. The man's tunic was torn by seven or eight bloody holes. He probably shaved yesterday, just before he was killed. And look at him now. He's got a beard on him that would have taken him at least a week otherwise. "See this one," laughed another fellow, who was clearing out a building which had been hit by a heavy mortar shell. He was dragging a Russian soldier whose head had been blown off. "You do better to go and shave yourself, if you want anyone to recognize you when it's your turn tomorrow. You give me a pain with your idiotic remarks. Anyone would think that's the first stiff you've ever seen." The veteran sat down on a heap of rubble, and opened his mess tin. We found a cellar which made a perfect defense point and moved into it with our two machine guns. We dug out the air vent which had been blocked by the collapse of the house, and even enlarged it, stopping work for a moment to watch a flight of Stukas pass overhead. Somewhere, not too far away, Ivan must have been drenched by a rain of bombs. Hals had made a hole in the masonry walls, and was estimating the firing possibilities. Lindborg was almost jubilant to be setting up this precarious shelter. Everything which now seemed to be working to our advantage stirred him to a strange excitement, in contrast to the helpless fear in the flaming alleys of Belgorod, which had reduced him to whining and pissing in his pants. 3 yards away, the veteran and I were shoving in supports to brace the enlarged air vent, which, at best, seemed a shaky proposition. Whenever we moved, Our helmets scraped against the low ceiling. Behind us, Kraus and two other grenadiers were removing the fallen stones and rubble which littered the floor. One of them picked up an empty bottle, and with a civilian reflex, stood it against the wall to wait for the harvest. As I've said, we had lost our non-com, and the veteran, who was an obbedge fritter, was now commanding our group.